Welcome to the Wandering Minstrel podcast. I'm David Buckingham, and today I'm speaking to Vasco Vasilev, the concertmaster of the Royal Opera House. Okay, so I'm here at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, London, with concertmaster Vasco Vasilev. Hi, Vasco.
Hi, David.
How are you doing?
Very well.
It was a bit chaotic coming here. I called at your house and you're preparing for a project.
One of those days when this morning I had an audition for the violins and to dash back, and we had a technological problem with Logic and Apple and all sorts of things. But I think we've sorted it out and we're back here just 1 hour before the performance.
Now for the easy part of the day, performing in front of a...
yes.
In the Royal Opera House. And what show is it tonight?
Tonight is a show called Anemoi and the Cellist. It's all about Jacqueline Dupré, the second cellist ballet, who was probably the most famous British cellist, and who sadly passed away from multiple sclerosis. And so they've made a story about her life in ballet.
Oh, cool. And you've been rehearsing this for a while?
Well, it's a typical thing. This actually is not the first time. This is the second time the ballet comes back, so things are a little bit quicker. But typically we have two alone rehearsals, the orchestra for just alone, where we read the music and we prepare the music. And then we have two stage rehearsals and then a general on the first night. Okay. Of course, the ballet has hundreds of rehearsals before that, and the cellist, who is one of our cellists, who is playing the cello, she's been with them rehearsing many, many times separately.
Sure, so it's a big gig for her.
Yeah. Massive, massive. Yeah. She's doing fantastically, she's great.
And all the music's composed for this?
The whole music, basically, it's been composed and arranged because Jacqueline Dupré was very famous with the Elgar Concerto, the Trout Quintet, so certain things that she was famous. Mm. The main thing is the Elgar Concerto because she was the most forte sonata. So there's a lot of cello music, but there are some bits and pieces that are written, original music just to, but not really melodies, they're more setting up the mood.
Oh, okay, yeah. Mm. That's what I was thinking, but they can use the Elgar cello concerto. Oh, cool. Okay, so on this podcast, I'm kind of interviewing people, interesting people that I've met through music.
Thank you for finding me interesting.
Of course. And not all musicians, but you're a musician. And of course, I met you through music. But the funny thing is, I think we were playing together for years before we met each other. Which sounds strange to people that don't know the business, because of course we met Don Quixote.
Yeah, the first Don Quixote, yes, I did it here, yeah.
Which was 10 years ago.
Crazy. Well, you look the same. Not that people can see on that, but...
We all look the same. But the reason we didn't meet is because you're playing in the orchestra pit.
Yes, and you were on stage.
And we kind of...
You guys were stars of the show,
First of all, thank you for being my accompanist. It's been a pleasure. But then, of course, I think later we did a project together, Trioperas.
Yes, we did first Trioperas, and you were amazing in that. I remember in Butterfly, I still remember you playing the American anthem. And actually that project is coming back together probably for Greece, so hopefully you'll be back from the Cirque du Soleil, because it will be at least 2 years, I think, before it happens. So
that's great, yeah.
I get a gig in Athens.
Yeah, I'd love to, yeah, that'd be great. It's nice to know it's coming back, because it was a big kind of investment of time and energy.
Yeah, and I think it's still a concept that should work very well.
Yeah. In fact, we were just before we came here, we were at your house, and I was drinking from a Triopera cup.
Yeah, but I especially made coffee for you, actually. It was intentional.
Oh, cool. Okay, cool. And then, of course, after Trioperas, we did a Bulgarian tour together, which was...
Yes, and I remember, because suddenly, I needed a musician that can play flamenco, but at the same time can read music. Because most flamenco guitarists cannot read music, and and we did the original Rondo Capriccioso with you, which was, you know, was a lot of work. And it's, I mean, until now I've been playing it lots, and it's a, such a fantastic piece of music. That, but we created that together originally.
Yeah, that was really nice, actually. Mm. And we got a video of that, which which I'll put on the on the website. And I remember, actually, I don't know if you know. I think I mentioned it last time. I had Folka Dystonia.
Yes.
And that was, and I'd kind of just started. I'd gone to study, you know, because I was worried about my hand. And then you called me, and I thought, well, if I'm not going to play again, having my last gig at the NDK in Sofia.
I think we had 4,000 people that day. Yeah, it's brilliant. Amazing. Yeah,
it was really nice. And I remember, and I think I said to you on the phone, I was a bit worried about my hand, but I didn't tell you at the time. And I think I just said to you, is there any solo play? And you're like, no, it's mainly accompaniment. And then you said, yeah, I just want you to open, though, with a 2-minute guitar solo. But it was fine. We did that. And it was funny because with the dystonia, with the hand problem, I was kind of re-evaluating everything. And you get a bit worried.
Yeah, of course.
And I was thinking, what do I do? And what do I want from music? You have this whole kind of your career before your eyes.
I think it's really scary for a musician. I mean, I've had suddenly... I was recording for 12 hours and suddenly my hands just ceased and I couldn't open my fingers. And I thought, oh my God, you know, what's going on. And lucky it was just a elbow, like golf elbow, because I was recording and then playing golf and I don't know which of the two. But it aggravated so bad that there was no blood coming into the hand. But Rocky was not. But you absolutely agree with you. This kind of thing is so scary. Once suddenly it happens, you realize, you know, we take it for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I did a nice interview with the doctor who was treating me in Germany. Actually, it's quite nice for musicians to kind of hear. And I'm going to do another interview with him for this podcast, which I think would be quite nice. Kind of help musicians prevent and kind of cure as well. But I remember when we did the tour and I was going through this, I was thinking, what do I want from my career? What do I want from kind of music? And will I be able to play the same things? And we did a rehearsal, just me and you, in this room, I think.
Yes.
And we were playing Asturias. And it was great. You were there. And I was kind of a few feet away from you and I was playing. And I thought, actually, whatever I've kind of put into this, like invested in time and energy to play in, what I want back is enough for me just to be kind of have the proximity to great musicians, you know, the great sound, just the fact that I'm here, because you can't buy that experience, you know.
Yeah,
you can't. And so I thought, yeah, it's good enough for me just to be able to play with, I don't know, people like Vasco and kind of do this is great. Wow. So and now the hand's kind of getting
fantastic. That's
better.
Cool.
So yeah.
And
so you were, am I right in thinking you were the youngest concertmaster?
Yeah, I was. It's almost 30 years ago that I joined.
30 years, wow.
Yeah. Now I'm become one of the older men in the orchestra. Times changed. When I came, I think I did my trial when I was 23. I joined when I was 24.
Wow.
So it's almost 30 years. I'm now 53.
Okay.
So it's...
And you were coming from where? So you're 23
years
old,
wasn't it? Well, actually, I studied in Moscow. Mm-hmm. And then I got chucked out at the Moscow Conservatoire.
Oh, really?
Yes, because I swore at the teacher of Communist Party or something. And it was already perestroika, so we couldn't care. But, you know, it was still, I had been present or whatever. Anyway, but I got a scholarship to go to study in England, in Guildhall. So I had this funny professor who said to me, I would give you a full scholarship and to study in the Guildhall, but you have to accept my way of playing Beethoven, Mozart. And I said, okay, well, whatever. So I joined him, and then I moved to another professor 2 years later in the Royal College of Music, and I was 21. But at that time, I did an audition for Lyon Opera. I led the London Symphony, London Philharmonic, and LPO when I was 19 or 20.
Wow. As a guest?
As a guest. Cool. But they wouldn't give me a job. I was too young. Uh-huh. So I did I did an audition for Opera de Lyon. One of the conductors was the boss there. One of the conductors, the LSO, was the boss there. He said, why don't you come on audition? We're looking for a leader. So I did the audition and I got the job. So in those 2 years in the Lyon Opera, between 21 and 23, I did two seasons. I played one Puccini opera, one Mozart, one, you know, a bit of everything. And then I got invited here to do an audition for the Royal Opera House job. And so when I was 23, I did the audition, and then I had two. In England, it's different from the continent, because on the continent, you know, do an audition, you get the job, and then you are probation period 1 year. But in England, you have to do a trial.
Okay.
So you do it. So you get one opera production and one ballet production as a trial, and then the orchestra decides they like you or not. So they have a lot of other leaders also trialing at the time. Anyway, I did Sleeping Beauty and Traviata with George Shorty, and I got a job.
Right. But was the audition for Concertmaster?
Yes.
Okay, it was. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in fact, no, it was leader, and then they decided that the job is more important than leader. The Concertmaster was more broad responsibilities than just being a leader.
Okay, and what's the difference between leader and Concertmaster?
Nothing really, okay. I think. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a word. It's like every job, you make out of the job yourself. You make the job. It's not.
Yeah.
You call. I mean, in France, I was called. The same job is called super soloist.
Super soloist.
Yeah,
okay. I quite like that.
Yeah, it was nice, no? Super soloist. And the second violin principal, which in England is called principal, was called chef d'attaque.
Chef d'attaque.
Yeah. Boss of the attack is like okay.
But what is, so for people who are listening to this who maybe don't come from an orchestral background or that aren't familiar, what is a leader though?
Well, basically, I think the leader, you have to, you know, if the conductor is shit, everybody starts watching you.
Okay.
You have a lot of solos, you have to play solos. You have to, in the opera, you have to accompany, of course, the singers, but they are solos, and the ballets, they are big solos. Mm. So you have to be up to international standard of playing, up to a soloistic standard to be the leader, especially of an opera house orchestra where there's so many solos in the ballets.
Yeah.
And then as a leader, of course, you're responsible for, everybody looks up to you, the orchestra, and the string players. So I'm involved in all the hiring of people in auditions, which I did today. You are kind of the bridge between the conductor and the orchestra, because my job is to make things happen whatever the conductor wants, like it or don't like it, but it's my job is to transfer his wishes of sound, of you know, in the technological way.
And do you take the strings away and do rehearsals with them without the conductor?
Sometimes, yes. Okay. We call them sectional rehearsals.
Okay.
So, for exceptionally difficult pieces or new repertoire, sometimes we put a sectional rehearsal.
Okay. And I remember hearing some trumpet players talking once about a great solo trumpet player and saying, yeah, he's a great soloist, but he's terrible in the section. He just doesn't play with everybody. So I'm guessing there has to be a combination.
Exactly,
the same,
that's the problem with leading, is that you have to switch different gears. You have to be able to melt with the, you know, to have your sound and everything melt with the rest and to lead, but at the same time to, you know, to switch to a different gear if there's a solo, or if you're playing opera, it's, or symphony. I mean, you have to be pretty multi-talented. It doesn't work to be only a great soloist, but you know, to be able to play with people.
Yeah, be a team player as well.
Mm.
We can always tell, because I'm doing this with a mutual friend of ours and colleague Dan Thomas, is a guitarist, and. When we're in the wings for Don Q, there's a violin solo that's just before.
Yeah.
And we can normally tell when it's you. Kind of. Oh, that's Vasco's in tonight. So it's nice.
Sound out of tune.
So you mentioned was it the Moscow Conservatoire?
Yeah. Well, actually I studied in the Central Music School, which is in Russia. This was, it's a bit, well, the Menuhin School in England was a prototype, was taken basically, was a copy of that. But basically the Central Music School in Moscow was kind of affiliated with the conservatoire. So my teacher is actually a professor in the conservatoire as well. But this school, the most important thing was to be able to play well the violin, maths, and the rest was, they were pretty relaxed about, and you didn't have to worry too much to be amazing in it.
In what are the other things?
Other subjects, mathematics, whatever. You know.
Oh, okay, so you're talking about...
So we even had an extra day free. Thursday was called Творческий день in Russian, which means day for creation. So basically, so you practice extra day to practice. So you had 3 days because we didn't have school Saturday, Sunday, and Thursday was purely for practicing. But I'm talking everybody was practicing 8 hours a day. So it's not, it was a school where you go and the portraits of the most famous Russian musicians were there. There was a school with lots of tradition.
Okay, and what age was this?
10 years old.
10 years old, from 10
to 18.
10 to 18, oh wow, okay.
And I spent 1 year in the conservatoire.
Okay, before you got thrown out.
Yeah.
And so you were living in Russia, your parents? I want to
yes.
Even further.
Well, my parents, both my parents are musicians. Mm-hmm. And my mother is a pianist, my father is a violinist. So they asked me what I wanted to do, and I to play the piano or violin, so I said violin. And I went to the Sofia Music School. I was accepted there.
Oh, so this, you were living in Bulgaria?
Yes, I was at the time. And then when I was 9 years old, my father realized that the Bulgarian school of violin playing is... I became quite famous in Bulgaria. I was doing movies, concerts. I was kind of a wunderkind.
At this age?
Yes.
Okay.
And my father realized that to get to the next level, I needed to go either to America or to Russia, where the best schools for violin, the best professors for violin were at the time. He wanted me to go to Juilliard School, so he... the president's daughter, who was quite, she was the minister of culture, and she was communist.
This is the Bulgarian?
Yes, okay. Everything talking about Bulgaria.
Sure.
She promised to send me to Juilliard School with a scholarship to study, because she was quite pro-Western, I mean, for those days. Anyway, that lady suddenly had a car crash, and she was killed in a car crash. So the number two boss of the party called my father and said, you can forget about America, because that time it was very Cold War and all that. But you can still go to Moscow. So we found out there were two teachers in Moscow that were famous to work for working with kids. And I went and did an audition for both of them. And then they asked me which one I liked. And the first one was very, very nice woman. She was nice, very nice woman. The second one, she came in the Moscow Conservatoire and behind with 10 students. And then she listened to the first one and practically threw him out of the room. With the violin following, and she won't get away with this kind of thing these days.
Wow. I mean, this is literal.
I absolutely loved her. I fell in love with her, and I.
Oh, the strict one. The
yes.
One did, okay. Yeah,
so
yeah.
I went to study with her.
So she obviously didn't throw you off.
No. She listened to me, and she said it was very interesting because she said, if you had come 8 months later, it would have been too late. Even at that age, because the Russian school of music is how they put the hands, how they do everything.
Really?
It's very, they believe that after, if you come, you still have to be a kid to form, you know, the technique and all that. And so when I came, then the Communist Party was absolutely amazing because they gave my father a job in the embassy. He was not even a party member, he was a violinist in the Sofia Philharmonic. They gave him a job in the Bulgarian embassy. They gave got a flat, a car, and said, your job is to look after him. And you can go to work, but you don't have to follow 9 to 6. It's, you know,
it's to look after your main, you as a growing...
Yeah, okay. Talent. So when I arrived in Moscow, my teacher said, okay, forget about concerts, no concerts, nothing. So for one year, I was basically playing scales and open strings. And then slowly, you know. But the Russian system is amazing because they knew, it's just how they give the repertoire. They will give you a certain piece, and once you pass that piece, you're on the next level of technical level, or musically, small dances that you study for this. It's unbelievable. And then they believed very much this system was that even if you're 10 years old, if you play something, it's better that it's an easy piece. But you play it as an adult, the quality of an adult when you're 10 years old, 11.
Everything.
Okay. That quality. Because then you would want that quality next time you play something else. Where, you know, a lot of the teachers, they give too early their students difficult pieces and they can't cope with it. And then they get used to not having that super quality.
Mm. Okay, so looking back kind of 30, 35, 40 years later, and 40 years later, you're kind of really glad you went through that system, chose that.
I don't know. Nobody knows what was happening. I mean, Dorothy DeLay is a very famous teacher in America, of course. Mm-hmm. She produced a lot of good violinists, too. Mm. Who knows? I mean, but I don't feel sorry that I went to Moscow.
Sure.
Not at all. No.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have known what would have happened if I was in America, but for the experience and everything, I wouldn't change it.
Yeah. That's great. And your father, did he move to Germany? Is that right? I mean,
When I was 17, I was sent for my first big competition because that was those days. That was the X factor do a competition. Now these competitions are not so important, but in those days they were very, very important. So I went to do a competition in Paris, where I got the Grand Prix. I was 16 or 17. 16.
Okay.
And so that was the first competition that I did. And they gave me the money, but they couldn't give me the money because I was underage and my father wasn't there. So they kept the money in this account. And I got 40,000 francs, I think, which was the equivalent of 4,000 euro, which was a lot of money, I suppose. Yeah. And so when I left Moscow and went to England, he asked me, he wanted to stay with me in England, but I was 18. I said, no, thank you very much. I'm very happy on my own.
Okay, so going back, so you were 10 years old when you went to Moscow. She said you couldn't play for 2 years, concerts. Yeah. So at 12, were you back flying back to Bulgaria and doing concerts?
I started doing 14, 15.
Okay.
Really, 15. Yeah. And then first competition, 16.
Okay.
And then at 18, I left. So.
Okay, and that's when you went to, came to the UK?
Yeah.
As we're here now.
And I did. Actually, I was still 17 when I left. Because I was born in October, so I was 17 when I did Kaufflech competition here, and then I did Paganini violin competition, which I won, and when I was in 1989, but just before I was turned 19.
Okay.
So with the money from the first competition, my father hadn't practiced violin for 8 years. He practiced, and went to Germany and did an audition and got a job.
Oh, wow, okay.
In Germany, with the German orchestra.
Okay, and did he become a conductor, am I remembering that right?
No. No, I was conducting, I conduct sometimes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that. Okay. And so when you won this competition at 19 that you just mentioned, did that kind of put you on the map here in the UK?
Not really. I mean, you know, the music business in the media is such a fast-moving thing. At that time, I won the competition, and I was still winning a lot of things. And it was a question of, well, I could carry on doing competitions, looking for agents, but then I had no visa, so I had to, you know, and I didn't want, so I needed a job. And the only jobs, I mean, as a freelancer, you can't guarantee as a soloist that you, how much work you're going to get. So somehow I decided at one point, well, you know, why not lead an orchestra, you know? And then, because as a leader of an orchestra, I work 4 months a year with the orchestra. I still have time to do a lot of solo work. And so I went that way, and that's, but primarily I decided to do it because of the visa first.
Okay, yeah. But they invited you for audition, so they knew of you?
Well, no, you basically, I mean, when you see the competitions I've done, it was obvious that I could play the fiddle, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So no, you have to apply, but sure. You know, they're always looking for leaders. It's always, if you look, the orchestras, it's not like what we said earlier on, that it's such a complex job that it's difficult to find.
Sure.
So there's always, if you look at the Philharmonia, LSO, whoever, it's every 2 years there's a vacancy or something.
Yeah. And what's the difference? Of course, you're leading the Royal Opera House Orchestra, which is both opera and ballet. And how does that differ, playing for the opera and playing for the ballet?
Well, the ballet has a lot more solos, and I get to play a lot of concertos. I just did Saint-Saëns concerto, I've done Stravinsky violin concerto, I've done Britten violin concerto, lots of solos. I mean, so it's a lot of fun working for the ballet. And then the big Tchaikovsky, you know, sonnets, they have amazing solos, Bayadere, you know, amazing. They're virtuoso solos, they're, you know, really difficult solos. So it's fun to do it. Mm. And then opera, I've done all the Wagners, probably.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Most, I've done, you know, The Ring, I've done Puccini, I love Puccini, you know. It's very different, because in opera you are always accompanying. In ballet, you don't feel that you're accompanying because the conductor has to accompany a physical art. Mm. But we as musicians, we don't watch because we're not watching the ballet, we're playing. So we don't feel like we're accompanying, we feel like we're playing. So it's very much similar to symphony.
Okay.
Symphony orchestra.
Oh, that's nice. And you said an interesting thing to me the other day. I think you'd been with your band and you'd done, you're on tour in Bulgaria, you've done quite a few shows, and you said it's great because you start to really get tight together. And you said something like, in classical, like playing here, it's interesting because you change repertoire all the time, but what you don't get is this playing the same piece and building it and building it and getting it tighter. And
yes, it's an interesting, you know, at the end of the day, everything is in the head. If you're playing in an orchestra and you're playing in a band of four, when you're playing solo, you basically want to improve all the time how you're playing, and you don't get really bored, I think, even if you play lots of times. But when you're playing violin, even though you're the leader, but there are 10 people playing the same melody, we're basically playing the same part together. Mm. And then that is difficult. You get bored if you play too many times.
Yeah.
Because you're not in charge of improving yourself, if you know what I mean. Because if you're playing Bach Chacon or Sting, you're playing on the guitar, you want to play it, you hear yourself, you always want to get better and better and better. But if you're playing it in a chorus, you know, you don't know, it's not the same.
Yeah, I can relate to this. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's an interesting kind of difference between the two. And I was with you on tour, as we said, in Bulgaria, and people coming up to you in the street asking for your autographs and photos. So you've obviously maintained a level of...
Well, I did the X Factor, so that's that kind of...
Okay.
I was one of the teachers, I mean, one of the juries on the X Factor. So I was already famous in Bulgaria because when I came back when I was 28 or 29, because I wasn't allowed to go back, because if I went back I would have been taken to the army for 2 years. So because of national service, I didn't go back until they didn't abolish, or I was too old for it, or whatever, but sure. I can't remember now. So I went and did, I had a pop band called Laureate, and we did a studio recording with Sting. With Sting's studio, he helped us produce the record, and that became a big hit in Bulgaria. It was just me, one viola player, and a guitarist. And we did lots of TV shows, and so then that was the beginning, you know, of getting famous. It was really nice that I went back actually to Bulgaria, not as a classical musician, but actually with a totally different project. Nice. There's lots of Piazzolla that we had done, like arrangements. And then, you know, I carried on building up on that, basically.
Yeah, and how often do you tour Bulgaria?
Well, almost every year.
Okay, great, yeah.
We just did a 20 dates.
Great.
So practically every village in Bulgaria.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice, yeah. I remember we did, I think, 15 cities when I went.
We did a lot, no, as well.
Yeah, that's nice. And an interesting thing, another nice thing, when I toured with you in Bulgaria, when I went to study flamenco in Seville, it was kind of... very early 2000s, I think, and in every cafe you went, there was Chambao playing.
Yes.
This group, and they were kind of the core. And for me, it was great because I was in the UK getting into flamenco, and all the flamenco here was a bit kind of stodgy,
yes,
a bit old-fashioned. And then I went there, and it was kind of cool. And there was like DJs mixing kind of cool sounds with flamenco, and I saw this band Chambao play at was in the Mezquita in Cordoba.
Yeah.
It was kind of like they went on at about 11 o'clock at night. It was kind of the, you know, just red skies, a kind of balmy evening. It was beautiful. Yeah. One of the concerts I really remember. And of course, when we went touring in Bulgaria, you said to me, "Oh, we've got the percussionist from Chambao coming."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, wow, this is great."
In fact, you replaced the guitarist from Chambao. It was Tony Cantero, really? Used to play with us, yeah. Ah. But then he moved to the Canarian Islands, and that's why he's not playing with us anymore. He's too far.
Okay.
But I played actually with La Marie as well, with the singer.
Okay, cool.
But I was crazy about that band too. I loved them.
Yeah.
There was another one, Ojos de Brujo, as well.
Yeah, Ojos de Brujo, yeah.
And this one, but... And it was so nice because, for example, I think that it's interesting because in flamenco, they don't mind the music being, I don't call, bastardized, you know, because basically, you know, they're putting new grooves to it. But, you know, people, classical music or folk music in Bulgaria, are so stuffy about it. It's like, okay, but okay. It's evolution of music. That's what you do.
Yeah.
You know, you can't. But you know, a lot of Bulgarian folk music, they call it pop folk, and they is absolutely hated by the mainstream.
Okay.
Because it's pop folk. But Chambao is basically pop flamenco. But
yeah, yeah.
They're not. The Spanish are much more open about it.
Yeah. Well, that's a shame because we did a Bulgarian rhythm piece, and I got it quite interested in some of it. And I think there's a lot of scope for doing cool stuff with
There is. It's just the borders when you have the singers in that. You know, in there they get very.
Yeah.
So now I'm working on a project where I'm using the voices, but we're using them on classical music.
That's nice. Yeah.
Rather than, you know, using the Bulgarian folk.
Sure, yeah. I'm just looking at the time because we're talking before a show. It's 7:20.
Yes, 5 minute call.
Five minute call. And when do you need to leave?
Now.
No. So I let Vasco go and play the first act, and we agreed to meet back in his dressing room during the interval to continue the interview. In the meantime, I got to enjoy the first act from the wings. Here's a small snippet of that before we continue with the interview.
This is something else called the Grand Design.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, we're back in business.
Back in business. So we just took a short break while you went and did the first half of the ballet.
Yes, I just played the Rachmaninoff symphony, you know, something else.
Nice way to take a break. And how was it? Did you play wonderfully?
Well, you know, it's a collective thing. I think we did okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's a beautiful piece, amazing music.
And the next part is going to be the cello.
Yeah, next part is
Jacqueline Dupre that we were talking
about.
So, we were talking about Juanito before,
yes,
our good friend from Chambao. And so I remember having this you know, when you said, oh, the percussionist from Chambao would play with us, I thought, oh, great. You know, this guy's like a legend. I used to listen to him all the time. And the first time I met him, kind of get to Bulgaria, get to Sofia, and I said, hey, so you're Juanito? He said, yeah. He said, listen, he said, David, he said, I sent my percussion stuff here, and he said, and I stuffed weed inside the the stands. He said, but I've had a heart attack, so would you mind helping me smoke it? In the first words I met from
well, actually, I used to record in their studio in Malaga, and because it was very hot and my house didn't have air conditioning, so I used to leave my violin in the studio because they had an air con. And these guys, once we stopped recording, Juanito and the other, they were smoking weed. I mean, it was absolutely... So when I arrived at Heathrow Airport, all the dogs were next to my violin, sniffing and checking, because it was stinking of marijuana, chocolate. But he's a good boy now. He's since the heart attack. Well, he's smoking something else, but not it's all legal.
I have to ask you, when you were a judge in Bulgaria, were you a nice judge or a nasty judge?
No, I was put to be Simon Cowell, so I was supposed to be the nasty one. I was put into that role.
Okay.
But it was not difficult, because in Russia, I grew up in very strict. It was totally opposite to the English, you know, were so polite about everything. So,
yeah.
So it was easy to slip back to Russian mode.
Okay. And how's the talent coming up in Bulgaria? Did you find particularly talented people in there?
Actually, I mean, the thing about these formats is that basically it's a format and they try to manipulate you. A lot of the people are hunted down. They find idiots, they find, you know, because it's a TV show, they have to make it. And you sit there for 8 hours listening to absolute rubbish, and then they put somebody quite decent, and you're so tired, and you think, wow, that's, you got the next Pavarotti, you know. So, in a sense, but, you know, it's still a great platform for young kids, and the two boys that won under me, actually, they got the first and the second prize. I was in charge of the boys. One of the boys is still, he's amazing. He's made it, you know. He's busy, he's producing, he's singing, he's doing his own shows. So, you know, I guess that is a success that he made it.
Oh, wow. And what's his name?
Rafi Pogosyan. Rafi.
And he's a singer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, but he's Armenian and he's very... entrepreneurial, so he's doing his own shows and he's taking part in other TV. He's even got his TV show, I think, now.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, he's so, like I said before, there are so many winners of Tchaikovsky competition, or there are so many winners of X Factor of the world, but how many actually made it out of them? You still have to make it. So,
yeah, that's true. Yeah,
you know, in is the UK, Australia, America, wherever, is still. I mean, how the UK? I know Leona Lewis. No, she win.
Yeah, she did. Yeah,
but that's about it.
I had a couple of friends, and they looked really good. Actually, they had one played the double bass, the other the ukulele. One was blonde, one was very ginger, and they wore. Matching outfits, but the opposite. So if one had blue flowers and a red dress, the other had red flowers, and they looked great. And they went to the audition, and the TV crew saw them and went straight for them. They thought they visually look amazing. They went straight up and said, oh, great, you know, can we see what you're doing? And they said, oh, great, and what do you do for a living? And he goes, oh, well, we're musicians. And that, they lost interest, because there's no story there.
Yep.
There's no, I'm a bin man.
Yeah, yeah, it's very much story-led, but that's TV for you. It's
Yeah.
But from that first X Factor, actually, quite a lot of people came. One, this singer particularly, he survived. He's a, you know, and girls. One of the girls who didn't make it even to the final, but she's made it too, quite big. So,
I guess you don't have to win, because if you can just get, if you get a clip on social media and the public kind of take a liking to you, even though you didn't win.
Well, and they signed contracts with this. They have draconian contracts. 3 years they have to work. They're slaves for 3 years for just because they took part in this TV show.
And that's not just the winners, is it? That's
no. This, even if you fall, because if you got like this girl, she got picked up by an agent. Well, no, she didn't get. Well, she got picked up by an aide, by a guy that does produces a lot, but he still had to pay the agency that had the contract.
And how many series did you do of that?
I only did one.
Okay.
In fact, I mean, I even had to travel, so I missed quite a bit. I did a tour. Well, X Factor. We recorded quite a lot in the summer, and then I had to miss two of the lives.
And you were touring with?
I was touring on my own as a soloist in Japan. And then I was touring in the Far East with Covent Garden Soloists, which is I have a band which is based from musicians of here.
Oh, nice.
And we do
chamber
music and small orchestra bits.
Oh, yeah. You seem to be in Japan a lot, so you have a nice kind of.
Well, I love Japan, and my girlfriend is Japanese, so I look for any opportunity to go back there. Mm. I work with this very famous Japanese pianist. She's 93 or 94, and she has an amazing story. Talking about stories, she's a complete marketing phenomenon, because she basically was a cleaner and didn't have any work and lost her hearing because of illness in her right ear. She was a promising pianist. Da, 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 da. Anyway, somebody in Tokyo saw her when she was 50 years old and made a drama about her. So there was a TV drama, like a Netflix drama about her life, because she was cleaning toilets in Germany. She is half Swedish, half Japanese. Anyway, after this drama, she became the highest paid pianist in Japan, and she did concerts like Budoka, you know, the big, well, the Michael Jackson, 10,000 seaters. Wow. Just alone, one piano. So I still tour with her. In fact, I have concerts next year with her again. Okay. And she's still there. I mean, unbelievable, 94.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Mm. And that is piano and...
Piano and violin.
We do.
But now she can only play 15 minutes. But still, you know, we play 2,000-3,000 seater halls. People pay €200 per ticket to see her.
Wow. Mm. That's incredible. And what's her name?
Fujiko Hemming.
I heard a story once that you had one of your party tricks was your encore, and you would say to the audience, name a number between 1 and 24, and someone would say 3, and then you'd ask someone else, and they would say 17.
So these are the Paganini caprices, because they're 24.
Yeah.
I'm too old for that shit now.
But that was a big thing, to have all 24.
Actually, when I came to play the audition at the opera house, normally I have to play one concerto, and I had prepared 3, I gave them a choice of 3 concertos, so that was fun.
Oh, really? And I also heard a story that, I don't know which conductor this was, but he put together an orchestra of first violinists to tour, like a kind of a dream team.
Yes.
And you were the first violinist of the first.
Well, actually, that's when I started touring Japan. No, there was an orchestra called Super World Orchestra,
okay,
which was made of only concertmasters.
Oh, wow, okay.
So not only in the violins, but in the cellos, the whole, so from the world, so... It cost an arm and a leg, because they had people from New York, from Boston, from Philadelphia, from, I mean, you name it, in Vienna, Frank, whatever. And the conductor that was my boss here before, Bernard Haitink, when you got to conduct that orchestra, you get to choose who's going to be your concertmaster. So he took me as his concertmaster.
Oh, nice.
So then I became the super concertmaster. Now I'm the... Now they call me the King's Concertmaster, because I did the coronation. So I was a concertmaster
for
the coronation.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah. And how was that?
That
was experience.
That was a real experience, because that was... You work in an opera house and you take part in these operas where the king is coming and So you're kind of used to that, but the real thing is much more fun. I mean, the biggest challenge was not to pee ourselves, because there was no toilet in the
chair. Really?
So we were there for 8 hours.
And where was this? At St. Paul's? Or?
No, in Westminster, which happens to be 5 minutes from my house.
Okay.
So it was the best local gig I had.
You had to go to the toilet.
No, you couldn't pass the street. It was impossible to leave.
Okay.
I mean, it was the amount of people with snipers. You won't believe it. It was amazing, because we were rehearsing And there were these kids, we were rehearsing in the school, in the Westminster School, and there's these kids playing football, and there's these guys going around with snipers get setting up, you know, for the this.
That's a real experience, yeah. Oh.
But it was a great orchestra and a great experience. I mean, we were next to the organ. I mean, next to that organ, David, the sound. And the conductor had his back to the, it was vibrating the whole, you know, organ when he was, and he was, we had a military orchestra, our orchestra, which was, we were just sat there, in a very small orchestra, because, you know, there's no space up there in, with the, where the organ player. And those organ players of the cathedral, they're incredible. And the kids, the chorus, and the military orchestra. I mean, it was an amazing gig to do.
Wow. And who conducted that?
Well, we had three conductors. One, the guy who was in charge of the chorus. So he was master of ceremony, and then military conductor, and Tony Papano, who is from here, the conductor, he was doing our band, but they had to all fit together. Wow. So they had TVs, and they were following basically the guy downstairs, who was the worst conductor of all, but because he was downstairs with the... He's an amazing chorus master, but he's not the proper, you know, symphony conductor. But they did a great job. It was amazing. Yeah.
Cool, and this must be televised as well, I guess. This is.
Oh,
yeah. I'll have a look at
that. No, it was a well-paid gig.
Yeah. Talking of well-paid gigs, you have a relationship with Sting.
Yeah.
And you played, have you played with him or for him, I think?
I played for him. I never played with him, actually. Well, he played with us once in his house. He performed, he played a Bach piece and he did the pizzicato in the bass.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, he played with us.
Because he used to live, did he live on the same street?
He did, but he sold the house.
Yeah.
Mm. But like I told you before, how I met him was his wife came here, did some charity for us. She was some concert, and I was playing, and she came to me and she said, "Do you mind coming and playing for my husband for his birthday?" And I'm like, and you know, I'm not really interested in, you know, playing birthdays. And I'm like, well, but he's the police, you know. And I'm like, your husband is policeman, and you want me to come to play? I mean, I thought she was threatening me, like, you know, the police. And because I wasn't a fan of the police, because I grew up in Russia where they were forbidden, so we didn't know about the police. Anyway, eventually, so I asked her for £10,000 to just go and play for 10 minutes. And then she agreed. And then I came and we played this gig. And we were rehearsing, and Elton John came, and Bob Geldof was there. And the guitarist, we were playing some Piazzolla, and the guitarist, what is it called? Where the sound comes from.
Oh, the amplifier.
His amp blew up. Okay. And nobody could fix it because all these musicians there, they had roadies, but they don't know. Oh, yeah. So this poor guitarist, he played electric guitar without an amp. And he got all these amazing people there. I mean, Madonna, it was an incredible amount of people there, yeah. Anyway, since then, Sting actually loves Bach and Piazzolla. Mm. So I did that first album with these kids that we did. So we did the Piazzolla. In fact, his manager wanted to take us up to tour us, but sadly, the first guy that used to tour the police with him driving a truck, you know, in America. But he passed away. He had a heart attack, so it was not too bad. I've got to go and play the cellist.
You've got to go and play the cellist?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I will let you go. And that brought an end to the interview. Vasco's music and tour dates can be found at vascovasilev.com. I'm David Buckingham, and this has been a Wandering Minstrel podcast.